Hi, everybody. My name is Danny Marsh. I'm an alcoholic. The Father Danny is that I'm performing a wedding ceremony for two friends of mine in a couple weeks, and I just got ordained as a minister, and it would make my grandfather, the rabbi, very proud if he knew that his grandson, the freebaser, was now an ordained minister. And if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what you get for the next 40 minutes. And I apologize. I have a sobriety date. It's April 24th, 1990. I have a home group. It's the Tuesday night solution group meeting in Sherman Oaks. I have a sponsor. He's a little garden gnome from Jerusalem named Yisrael C. He's a lovely, lovely, very short man. With a beard and a yarmulke and a very religious guy who I haven't told yet that I've been ordained. I think I'll wait till after Yom Kippur. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Layla for inviting me and then giving up the commitment and not showing up. Because it does wonderful for my incredible already low self-esteem to have people invite me and then disappear. And if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you hear nothing else, just know that for the next hour you're safe. Like, we need nothing from you here. Just take a deep breath. The heat's off. Just relax. And if you can come, if you can try not to have a drink tonight and come back and hang out with us again tomorrow, that would be great. And if you drink tonight, come back and hang out with us tomorrow anyway. I don't get surprised when we drink. I get surprised when we don't drink. Like, there was no way I could stop drinking. So if you're new and you're scared and you're sweating crystal meth out of your spinal fluid and whatever you're, you know, if you're tweaking, whatever it is, welcome. You're in a place that wants you. And when I got here, there weren't a lot of places that wanted me. I want to thank Beverly for a great, like, you heard everything you needed to hear in the 10-minute talk. We could just have 45 minutes of 11-step work and then go home, because that was a beautiful talk. Thank you so much. And happy birthday. Happy birthday to all the birthday people. That's really impressive. And I want to thank my hosts. We went to dinner beforehand, got to celebrate 1-year birthday, which is just freaking genius. You know, when she told me she had a year, I was like more excited than when I take a cake for 30 years. Like, it was better for me to hear that than, you know, and it's awesome. And we went to dinner and we had a really lovely time. And if you're new, I'm sure you're thrilled for us. I'm sure you're sweating something out of your spinal fluid and going, oh, I'm really happy for the Jew at the podium. Really, I am. Because when I was new and I heard you were having a good time, I was dying. And when I heard you were having a good time, my hope was that you would get hit by a bus after the meeting. Because you were like all these spiritual vicars, and I was scared and broken and bleeding and dying when I got here. Like, I drank, right? I grew up in L.A. No, that didn't cause my alcoholism. It's just where I grew up. And I had a mom and a dad and a little brother, and when I was 13, I got a little sister, and it was a really lovely nuclear family, and there wasn't, you know, I hear all kinds of different backgrounds and different upbringings and challenging experiences, and that wasn't mine, right? That wasn't mine. I came from a really lovely family. It was loving. It was big. It was nuclear. Grandparents and cousins and aunts and uncles and all overachievers, like all overachievers. And my grandfather was a rabbi in Hollywood. I didn't make that part up. He was a rabbi in Hollywood, and my first drunk was at my bar mitzvah. I got drunk right before the service. I threw up on the pulpit. I threw up before the Torah portion. He had invited 1,800 congregants to come celebrate the prodigal grandson. And I couldn't make it through the Torah ceremony. And then we went to a party at my house for 350 people, and I drank all night, and I threw up all night, and I embarrassed my mom, and I embarrassed my dad, and I embarrassed my grandparents, and I didn't care. I didn't care, and I woke up the next morning. My only thought was, I cannot wait to do this again. Like, I didn't think, there was no remorse, there was no, look at what I did. It was, I can't wait. That sense of ease and comfort that I felt with that first drink, it finally relieved the insecurity and the low self-esteem and the separate. I believed all my life that you guys had a different set of tools than I did. Like, you guys knew how to navigate the planet in a way that I wasn't equipped to do. And I didn't know how to get there until I took a drink. And once I took a drink, I got the tool set. And that's how I drank. I didn't socially sip a glass of champagne and get here. I drank all bets off from the first drink that I took. And, you know, and then I got introduced to pot. I talk a lot about drugs. I'm sorry if the talk about drugs offends anybody. Bill didn't write about drugs until the fifth page in his story, when he said he went to a doctor and the doctor gave him a sedative, and the next day found Bill taking both gin and sedative. And then in Dr. Bob's story, he waited till page 7, where in his story, where he said, in order to calm his shaky nerves so he didn't have to drink before work, he took a bunch of sedatives every day so he could wait until after work to start drinking. And I thought, if drugs were good enough for our founders, they were good enough for me. And giddy up, I did them. You know, I get confused. If you're new, you'll get confused too. I still get confused when I hear people say drugs are an outside issue or that's not part of alcoholism. I can tell you for me, and all I'm sharing is my experience. I'm not an expert on this deal. I'm not anything other than a drunk who hasn't had a drink in a little while sharing my experience. Is that drugs were as big a part of my story as anything else, and they all contributed to my alcoholism, right? Because I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and whether it's alcohol or pot or cocaine or acid or any of the other things that I took, once I ingest one of those things, I cannot predict within a month and a week, a year, an hour, if I'm going to be given the luxury to be able to stop. And if you're new and you have that same experience, welcome. Welcome. Take a deep breath. Welcome. So I got introduced to pot. I hated pot. I smoked it every day for a decade. And I always felt like a puppy on linoleum. You know, like I was really busy, but I never went anywhere. Like I never, but I was busy. And then I get introduced to cocaine. My first experience with cocaine, I should have known it was trouble. And this could tell you how old I am. I got fronted a dime bag. And then I did it all, and I knew it wasn't enough, and I refused to pay for it. And I got in a fight with the dealer, and he ended up in a trash can in our high school quad. And I went on to a much bigger and better life. And you know, so I did a lot of that. And I'll never forget high school graduation weekend. My friend Artie Simon his parents had a place up in Lake Arrowhead, and he said, you know, let's go to this house in Lake Arrowhead. We'll each buy an 8-ball, and we'll spend the weekend doing it. And I did mine on the drive up. And then I stole some of his and helped him spend the weekend looking for the stuff he lost. But here's where I started to understand I'm different, right? He called me a year later and said, it's our 1-year anniversary from high school graduation. Let's go back up to Arrowhead. I still have some of that blow left. I'm like, are you kidding? I've stolen thousands of dollars between then and now to get what I needed to get. And that's what I did. I used to go to my grandmother's and I used to steal 20s out of her wallet. And I used to steal anything in the medicine cabinet that said, do not operate heavy machinery. It wasn't until I was 3 years sober I realized I'd been stealing antibiotics for a decade. And it's like, I never got high, but I never got sick. Like, it was a good trade-off. But that's who I am. Like, I'm going to steal from you. I'm going to get what I get. And if you get between me and the drink, I will kill you to get to the drink. Nothing stands between me and the drink. And in 1978, in August of 1978, I was gone for the afternoon. And I came home to find out that my little brother had died in a mountain climbing accident. And it sucked. And 3 weeks later, I was taking a walk with my dad at LA Valley College, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. And it was vicious. It was brutal. It ripped out every sense of safety and security and comfort and all of that stuff that I experienced my first 18 years, and they were gone in 3 weeks. And I remember going to the rabbi at the time and saying, what do I do with this? How do I wrap my head around this? And he said, I shake my fist at God. And I said, there's no connective tissue there. There's nothing that gives me any sense of ease and comfort in what you said at all. And I went off. And what happened for me is, although those experiences shaped and changed and modulated my life, it had zero to do with my alcoholism. Absolutely zero. Because if that had anything to do with my alcoholism, I could go to a grief recovery seminar and I could freebase like a normal guy. But I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. So I drank behind that, and I got loaded behind that, because one of my defects of character, one of my favorites that I still use when I can get away with it, is opportunism. When people would confront me and say, do you think you're drinking a little much? Do you think you're writing too many bad checks? Do you think you're going down the wrong path? And I had relatives trying to help me, and I had people trying to help me all over. My general response is, look what I've been through. Wouldn't you do what I'm doing if you've been through what I've been through? And they left me alone, because everyone in my life wanted to believe me. Everyone in my life wanted what was best for me. And I drank for a really long time behind that. I moved to San Francisco. Ostensibly to go to college, but what I was really doing was chasing her. And she didn't want to be chased, like, at all. And we got there, and like a week after we got there, she broke up with me. And I ended up living with this really militant woman in Haight-Ashbury, and thought I was going to get killed every day. And then became president of my fraternity. Which was great, because the treasurer did more coke than I did. And we were perfect together. And then I burned all the bridges in the Bay Area, and I came back to L.A. And I ended up in this little apartment in Toluca Lake. And I tell the story for many reasons. And then at the end of the story, I'll tell you where it really got me. I ended up in this little apartment in Toluca Lake. I like to date by the hour. I really like to date by the hour. And my grandfather was a Russian immigrant, not the rabbi, my other grandpa, and he came to this country with nothing, didn't know the language, didn't have a job, didn't have a skill set. He came to, landed on Ellis Island, he learned the language, he went to school, he developed a career, he built a better life for his kids and his grandkids than the one he was given. And I was too loaded to go to the hospital the night he had a heart attack. I was almost too loaded to make it to the funeral. But when they were handing out the estate checks, I was first in line. And I grabbed that check and I put it in the bank, and I did whatever I did when I had money at the time, is I called an escort service. And she came, and she brought a freebase pipe, and she stayed for 6 months. And I don't know about the rest of you men in this room, but my first thought when I ingest cocaine is long-term Neanderthal sexual relations. And unfortunately, the last thing that's humanly possible is for me to be an active participant. So if you can picture the short, fat, mulleted Jew waddling around his apartment with his underwear around his ankles, chasing a sex worker for 6 months, getting absolutely nowhere. I didn't know what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization was. I thought they were normal dating rituals. And so I tell this story when I'm talking, and I was talking, I think, up here from my friend Annette one Friday night, and in the chat she writes, I think I was that woman. I fell out, like I couldn't finish my talk. Like it was all over, because I kept looking at her going, was she? Was she? Was it? It's possible. She goes, I could have been. And I love my friend Annette, and she's not here tonight either, which affects my self-esteem. But I hope to see her before I leave. What happened for me is my grandpa spent his entire life building a life, better life for his kids and his grandkids, and I smoked it up with a sex worker in 6 months. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what you're bringing to us. I don't know what that black hole of shame is. I don't know what that soul sickness is that you're unwilling to separate yourself from. But that's what I was bringing to you, and that's what I was taking to the grave. The shame was killing me more than the cocaine. Right? The shame and the guilt and the incredible self-loathing was killing me more than the cocaine. And I got asked to leave that apartment by the U.S. Marshals because the landlord wanted rent and I didn't want to give it to her. So they came over one morning and packed my bags and put them on the lawn, and I ended up in a little apartment in West Hollywood with a buddy of mine. And one night I was doubled over in a whole bunch of pain and I didn't know what to do about it. And I went to the Cedars-Sinai emergency room and they gave me a shot of Demerol and they said, whatever you do, don't drink. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I went home and I drank a fifth of vodka out of my bed because that was my bar of choice at the time. Here was my drinking pattern at that point. If I got up and made it to work, I would work. I would drink two bottles of airplane vodka on the way home from work so that I could get started. And then I would drink a fifth or two of Thrifty's Blue Brand vodka in my bed. I would get up the next morning, I'd brush my tongue, I'd throw up the bile from the vodka from the night before, I'd get back into bed, I would turn on a Highway to Heaven rerun, and then I would drink what was left of the vodka. And, you know, I used to use all my sick days by January 3rd and be well on the way. Like, I was a mess. So I went to Cedars, they gave me a shot of Demerol, they said, whatever you do, don't drink. And I went home and I drank a fifth of vodka. And here's where I start to understand how the disease of alcoholism manifests in me. I believe I play by a different set of rules than anybody else on the planet. And whatever you citizens have to adhere to, I'm a little special, I'm a little different. Look what I've been through, don't you know? And the next morning I knew I was going to a doctor. I knew he was going to draw blood. And I believed to my innermost self that he would not find alcohol in my system. Believed it. Like, it wasn't a delusion. I believed it. And I went and he drew the blood and he came back and he said, dude, he didn't say dude, it sounds better. He said, do you drink? And I said, yes, sir, I have a glass of wine a night like anybody else. And he said, it's noon, you have a 0.25 blood alcohol level. He said, you also have a distended liver and I'd like to check you into the hospital to detox your liver. So they checked me into the hospital to detox my liver. The detox was too hard for my heart to handle. I ended up with an atrial fibrillation of my heart. I was in coronary care for 3 days because the detox from alcohol was too hard for me to take. And then they said I was a candidate for the chemical dependency unit. And I thought, that sounds joyous. We can do that. So they're detoxing me with a drug called Ativan. I really like Ativan. Really. Like, I would have taken one on the way here tonight, but I thought, you're frowning on that. So I didn't. But so they're detoxing with Ativan. They thought it would be fun to watch me play volleyball on Ativan. So I broke my ankle in two places. And then they said, we're going to a place called the Log Cabin. And I thought, cool, pancakes. This is like civilized. I can do this AA thing. And so I'm in rehab. I put on my best outfit. You got to understand, I'm the same height, maybe an inch taller than I am now. I weighed 235 pounds. I had the San Fernando Valley crystal meth speed drummer's mullet. I had a huge bushy beard. I put on my best outfit at the time, which was a purple and gold striped shirt and gold MC Hammer harem pants. And they wheeled me down Beverly Boulevard and up Robertson Avenue at 7 o'clock in the morning. And they carried me up those three beautiful steps of the log cabin and they pushed me way over in the corner. And how you guys knew I was a newcomer, I still don't know. Like, it's still foreign to me. But you were really kind. You gave me coffee and you said, keep coming back. And I was like, leave me alone. Like, just stay away from me. You're all like perky and cheery and I'm dying. And I didn't know what AA was. I had never been exposed to it. I had never experienced it. You guys were just all really chipper at 7:30 in the morning. And I hoped you got hit by a bus afterwards. And I did 30 days in that unit, and it was beautiful. And I'm, because I'm a people pleaser and an opportunist, and I tell you exactly what you need to hear to get you off my back. That's my goal. My goal is to tell you what you need to hear to have you leave me alone. So I did that in the hospital for 30 days, and at the end of 30 days, we had this ceremony called a coining ceremony, where they pass around a coin around the room, and they say, "Love Danny, we love you, Danny, you're amazing. Danny, you'll grow up to be president of Alcoholics Anonymous someday, Danny." And it was a beautiful, joyous, weepy event, and I put the coin in my pocket, and I got in my car, and I went to a liquor store, and I bought 2/5 of vodka, and I went home, and I started drinking again. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me really specifically. The difference between the heavy drinker and the alcoholic is the heavy drinker, given sufficient reason to stop, stops. I had a distended liver and atrial fibrillation in my heart. They told me if I drink, I'm going to die, and I cannot stop. It's not that I will not stop or I should not stop. I cannot stop. I cannot replace the cycle of spree and remorse with the cycle of commitment and surrender left to my own devices no matter what. And for 3 days, I drank in such a pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralizing way that I had never experienced before. And on April 23rd, 1990, I was standing on the front porch of my house with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in an overnight bag waiting for my mom and baby sister to take me back to the chemical dependency unit. And that pain and fear and anger and sadness and disgust and terror that I saw in their eyes in that moment, I haven't had to see in anyone's eyes in over 32 years. And if that's as good as Alcoholics Anonymous gets, I can't pay you back in lifetimes. So when I'm asked to come and drive up here and give a talk, you bet your ass I am. Right? You bet your ass I am. Because I got two actions, right? I'm either walking towards a drink or away from a drink. Those are the only two actions I have in my life. And the greater the opportunities I take to walk away from a drink, the greater the opportunities I have to live this gifted life beyond my wildest dreams that you've given me. And on April 23rd, 1990, I could not stop drinking. And on April 24th, 1990, the drink problem was removed. Without any thought or effort in my part, the drink problem was removed. And what happened for me is I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to the cabin every morning for a decade. I got a sponsor. His name was Bob Braithwaite. He was a lovely man. He had never worked a step. I had never worked a step. We were perfect together. And I called him every morning and I said, "Hi, Bob, it's Danny." And he said, "Hi, Danny, I love you. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Call me tomorrow." And what he did is he made AA a safe place for me. I didn't have to clean his backyard. I didn't have to do the steps by Tuesday. I didn't have to, like, I hear lots of crazy stuff and it works. I'm not judging. Okay, I'm judging it a little. But no one could be meaner to me than I was to myself. So that tough love approach would it check, I'm out of here. And he made AA safe for me. And after a little while, I needed to work the steps, and I got another sponsor, and we worked the steps through some pamphlets and handbooks, and neither of us drank the whole time we were doing that. So I'm not judging it. It works however you want to work it. When I was 6 months sober, I was going to drink. Like, the walls were closing in, and I couldn't catch my breath, and I knew I was going to drink. And I went to the beach, and I sat on the beach, and I said, "If there's something bigger than me, help." Because I don't believe in a power greater than myself. The power greater than myself killed my dad and my brother. Like, I can't, there's nothing there. And what happened for me is I took a nap on the beach. That was my spiritual awakening. And then that little voice came in and said, "Who do you think's kept you away from a drink for 6 months?" And I was like, oh. So I got busy. I started working the steps. I got another sponsor. You can just imagine the mullet and the harem pants. There was not a lot of dating. I know it's shocking, but there was not a lot of dating going on. And I stalked this woman at my morning meeting because I'm a stalker. I have two relationship skills, stalking and snubbing. It's really all I got. Because I like to date by the hour. There wasn't a lot of, like, romance. So I stalked this woman at my morning meeting. She was a hairdresser. I had a mullet. I thought we'd be perfect together. But I had no clue how to ask anybody out on a date. So I figured if I made a hair appointment, in 1 hour of uninterrupted time, I could con her into going out with me. And we went out on a Monday night. I'll never forget it. The stars were shiny. The moon was full. We were driving. I knew like 30 seconds into this deal that she was mine forever, because I'm kind of like the jihad of dating. And she didn't even know my first name. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. She was mine. And we had a lovely date. And the next day, I put flowers on her doorstep and cards on her car, and I called, I don't know, 30 or 40 times to make sure she hadn't forgotten about me. And then the next day I mixed it up and I put the flowers on the doorstep and the cards on the car and called 40 more times. And on the third day she dumped me because I was freaking insane. Like, I was nuts. And then she ended up getting busy doing her stuff and I got busy doing my stuff. And we ended up going out again. And then after we went out for a little while, we moved in together. And right after we moved in together, she told me she was going to go to Hawaii with a friend of hers. She said, honey, I'm going to Hawaii with my friend Tony. What I heard was, honey, I'm going to Hawaii to have sex with everybody on the island except you. So I freaked out. I called my sponsor. He said, I'm going to tell you exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to march home and you're going to tell her that she's got a choice to make. Either you or Hawaii. She can't have both. And if she chooses Hawaii, you're going to pack her bags and you're going to put them on the front lawn and you're going to tell her to have a nice trip. And I thought, okay, it's a little harsh. A little harsh. But I'm going to be that good AA soldier. I'm going to follow directions. And I marched home and thank God she was at work. Thank God she was at work. Because I opened the big book to page 69 where it says, now about sex. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Counsel with others is often helpful, but we do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. And then 6 pages prior to that in the book says, for any of this to work, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Which means it's not my job to take away you having the dignity of your own experience. It's my job to share my experience, strength, and hope, and trust that my higher power will take care of me, and your higher power will take care of you. I'm not it. So I read that thing. I married her. We've been married 26 years. And I called a man named Scott Redman that I had heard talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I need help. And he said to me in that beautiful voice, honey, I can help you. And I knew in that moment that I was taken care of. And I went over to his house. He died 14 years ago, and I miss him. I miss him. Just, he's such a delicious man. I went over to his house, and we opened the big book to chapter 5, and we got on our knees, and we read the third step prayer with one another. He didn't pray it at me. It wasn't a sponsor to a sponsee or a baby to a whatever. It was one alcoholic holding hands with another alcoholic inviting God into the solution. And then he introduced me to the inventory process as it's outlined in the book. Resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. The three areas of my life where alcoholism presents itself the most, where if I keep it right here in front of me at all times and treat it like a real piece of business, I have an opportunity to grow and overcome in a way that I didn't know beforehand. Resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to actually kill. That's what the book says. It says these resentments must be mastered, but how? I couldn't wish them away any more than I could alcohol. And then he showed me how to deal with the resentment. I put my resentment, let's say I'm resentful at my wife. I know it's a stretch, but let's say I am. The cause, she said good morning the wrong way. Now, you're laughing. I got 32 years sobriety, but I know what she's thinking. When she says, so I'm resentful of my wife, she said good morning. But what she meant was, look at all the things you haven't done in our 26-year marriage. Look at all the losing things you've done. Why didn't you take care of this? When are you going to take care of that? Why haven't you? So already, my first thought is, I'm taking you out. Like, you're done. And all she said was, good morning. But I got alcoholism. I got a nasty case. I'm resentful of my wife because she said good morning. What does it affect in me? It affects my self-esteem. I'm married beneath me. It affects my personal relations. I'm willing to, it affects my pocketbook because I've wasted way too much money on this woman. It affects my ambition because it makes me want to be less of a good husband. It affects my personal relations because I'm willing to assassinate her character to anybody that'll listen. And it affects my sex relations because I start withholding all of this from her. And all she said was good morning, but I got alcoholism. And Scott taught me what to do with that information. He said, disregard the other person entirely, the resentment's mine. What are my defects of character that if God were to remove, the resentment would be lifted? What I want is my wife lifted. What I need is the resentment lifted. So if I put her out of the picture, what are my defects of character? I'm a mind reader. I'm grandiose. I'm punitive. I'm retaliatory. I'm judgmental. I'm sober a little longer than she is, and I'm closer to God than she is. So I've got a little spiritual pride. I've got a little false pride. I'm punitive. I'm retaliatory. I like to, silent scorn works really well in our house, and looming. If I mix silent scorn and looming together, it's a lethal combination. And all she said was good morning, right? All she said was good morning. But now I have a platform, I have a springboard, I have a way with which to engage this power greater than myself that I did not want to believe in when I got here, but to go, Pop, help. Pop, can you relieve me of some spiritual pride? And my firm belief is if God's powerful enough to separate me from a drink, he's powerful enough to separate me from some spiritual pride. And my responsibility at the end of the seventh step is to behave like a guy who's had spiritual pride removed. And I'm sorry about the gender-specific pronouns. I use God. I use male. I don't mean God or male. I haven't learned completely how to incorporate they instead of him. I haven't. And I have this lovely 20-year-old daughter who holds me up to that all the time. And she doesn't let me get away with not knowing anymore. Like, and I love and respect her, so I'm really mindful and I'm really careful and I screw up all the time. So please don't let the gender-specific pronouns affect when I talk about God or him or he or anything. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. And then the fear part of the inventory. So that's the resentment part of the inventory. The fear part of the inventory, I'll never forget it says exactly what to do with fear, right? We put our fear down on paper. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. At once. Not next Thursday and not after I've done a bunch of Hail Marys. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. So my wife's in the delivery room with my daughter, labor and delivery, and she's been in labor 24 hours, and I'm free. Let me back up. Must have been the Caesar salad. So I'd been trying to make amends to that apartment I got thrown out of for 14 years. And I used to drive by the apartment looking for the landlord's phone number, trying to find a way that I could reach out to them. And every time I drove past that apartment building, it was like a little knife in my heart. It was a little knife in my heart. And I had to drive past it almost every day. And finally, one day, I saw the phone number with a for rent sign. And I called her up and I said, hi, my name is Danny Marsh. I'm sure you don't remember me. And she said, oh, I remember you. I was a really irresponsible tenant and I treated your property with great disrespect. And I'm not the same guy that I was when I rented your apartment. And one of the ways I need to continue to not be that guy is I need to come to you and ask you what I need to do to make matters right. And she started crying and I started crying and it was a beautiful spiritual experience. And then I said, I may owe you some money. And she threw out this staggering amount of money. And I wanted to say, but hey, we just had this connection, really? And instead I said what you taught me to say, which is thank you. You know, and I wrote her a series of post-dated checks till the year like 2087. And and that was on a Monday. She cashed them all on the Friday we were checking into the hospital to deliver my baby. So we're in the labor delivery room, and I'm freaked out of my mind for so many reasons. And I remember the fear inventory. So I'm on my knees in the hallway of the labor and delivery room writing down, I'm afraid I'm going to be an abusive father. I'm afraid I'm going to be a horrible father. I'm afraid I'm going to drop my kid from the changing table. I'm afraid I'll never be able to afford being a dad. I'm afraid I'll write a bad check to the hospital. And I called Scott at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I read in the inventory, and I got on my knees in the labor and delivery room and said, "Dear God, I am afraid. Please remove my fear of being a horrible dad and direct my attention to what you would have me be." And I can tell you, 20 years into this deal, I'm a great freaking dad. I am a great freaking dad because, thank you, it's not me, because I don't punish my kid for my alcoholism. And I screw up all the time. We had an experience a couple years ago. My daughter was 17, had just gotten her learner's permit, and her best friend was 17, just got her license. And they were out on a Saturday. I came home from work on a Saturday. I said, "Where are they?" And my wife said, "They're, you know, Hattie's driving, Ruby is my daughter. Hattie's driving Ruby around. They're just going to get boba or something stupid, whatever the hell boba is." And I said, "Wait, Hattie's driving?" Now, what I failed to mention is that my daughter is a nationally ranked debater. So I'm already losing. Like, I lose when I say hi. So Hattie just got her license. Ruby's got a permit. We're not supposed to be able to do that. So I had pulled up four or five articles refuting what they were doing. And they walked in the house, and I said, "Babe, how dare you? You know, if you're out driving with Hattie, you're going to lose your permit. She's going to lose her license. Insurance is going to get canceled. You're not allowed to do that, blah, blah, blah." And before I had a chance to show her any of that stuff, she had texted me three articles to the contrary. And she was right. And what happens for me is when my back's up against the wall and I'm hurt, I only have one reaction, and that's to hurt you more. That's the only thing in my playbook. So I look at her and I say, "Babe, I am so disappointed in you. I thought you were smarter than that." At which point my wife lovingly jumps in and says, "You know what? You can talk to our kid any way you want about anything you want, but you may not do that. That's unfair." So I had one thought in that moment, and that was, one bullet will take them both out. Just one. And instead, I went outside, I took a deep breath, I said, "Pop, who do you need me to be?" I paused when agitated, highly overrated, but I did it anyway. And I walked back inside and I said, "Punkin, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry I did that. You're growing up and I don't know how to do this, and I'm scared. And when I get scared, I get angry. But here's my promise to you, is that I will do my best to learn with you how you're growing up." And that to me is the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's the music and the magic and the love that I hear in this room. It allows me to have that moment with my kid. That one moment. She just moved to college and one of her friends was over during spring break. I'm the cool dad, by the way, because they think I'm the cool dad, and I don't care why. I just want to be the cool dad. But one of her friends was over during spring break, and I said, "Let me just ask you a question. I'm not trying to narc on my kid, but on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 meaning you can see the floor, 10 meaning it's time to call Health and Human Services, how's Ruby's dorm room?" And she looked and said, "Oh, Mr. Marsh, I can't answer that." And my kid is someone who's grown up to be comfortable in her own skin. Right? And that's such a... I got to move her back to D.C. for her sophomore year, and I watched the way she was greeted in the hallway as we were moving in. And these are all these friends, like these from around the world in different sets of, you know, what their ideologies and how they comport themselves. They just love her. And as a dad, you don't want anything more. So anyway, enough about fatherhood. So then the sexual part of the inventory, where am I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Everywhere do I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Only if I open my mouth. Who did we hurt? I hurt you. I hurt me. Maybe some livestock, I don't remember. Where was I at fault? That's the most beautiful part of the sexual inventory. Where was I at fault? What are my defects of character that are at work here that are separating me from the opportunity to be the guy I want to be? Am I selfish, self-seeking, self-centered? Am I punitive? Am I grandiose? Am I filled with lust? What's going on? Because if God's powerful enough to remove my defects in the seventh step, he's powerful enough to handle them here. And then the most beautiful part of this, of the sexual inventory, what should I have done instead? Who's the sober, adult, married man that I want to be? And the bottom of page 6 and 9, it says, in this way, we help shape a sane and sound ideal for our future life. The right answers come if we want them. So all of a sudden, I have this design for living, right? I have this blueprint of my alcoholism with which to start to engage this power that I didn't believe in when we got here to help. It talks about it in the book. It says the purpose of our book is to introduce you to a power greater than yourself to help solve your problems. And that was the introduction for me. And I always tell the story because, you know, there's that line in chapter 5 that said, we stood at the turning point, we asked his protection and care with complete abandon. And all I ever wanted was to be cared for. So when Ruby was 7 or 8 years old, we had this goldfish in our house named Edie. And Edie had been with Ruby her whole life, and I came home from work one night, and Edie was belly up. And when I was a kid growing up, our family dog died. My mom didn't tell me for a decade. So I didn't want to be that parent. So I went into Ruby's room. I said, Pumpkin, I got some really sad news. Edie's dead. And she said, oh, Pop, that's really sad. I said, what do you think we should do? She said, you know, Pop, we should take her back to the ocean and release her back to her family. I thought, oh, my God, that's so sweet. But it's 8 o'clock at night. We live in the San Fernando Valley, and I want to be a good dad, but not a great dad. And I said, Pumpkin, can you come up with something else? And she thought for a minute, and she said, yeah, Pop, we can flush Edie down the toilet, and eventually she'll end up in the ocean. And I thought, I love my kids. So Cindy grabbed Ruby. I grabbed Edie. I threw her in the tank. I plopped her in. I said, Pumpkin, is there anything you want to say before we say goodbye? And she said, and I quote, dear God, thank you for allowing Edie to be with our family this long. Now please gently take her home to hers. Aww. 14 years ago, my sponsor Scott's lying dying in the hospital, liver cancer, 2 hours from moving on. And 7 years ago, my mom's in the hospital getting ready to move on as well. And I don't know how to do this. Like, I'm a runner. I'm not a stayer. I don't know how to lean in. You taught me how to lean in. But I want to bolt. And I'm holding Scott's hand and I'm rubbing his brow and I'm rubbing his forehead and I'm kissing him. And the only thing that popped into my head was Ruby's prayer. Dear God, thank you for allowing Scotty to be with us this long. Now please gently take him home. And thank you for allowing me to have a mommy this long. Now please gently take her home. And what happens for me is if I don't treat my alcoholism like a real piece of business right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I miss the whole thing. And I'm unwilling to allow alcoholism to take me out of any of it. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what you're bringing to us. And I don't know what it is that you don't want to miss. But I can promise you, if you treat your alcoholism like a real piece of business in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to miss anything ever. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks. Yeah.